The headlines: Israeli troops shoot dead yet another Palestinian in the West Bank amid heightened tensions in the occupied territories. North Korea's leader pledges to strengthen the country's nuclear weapons program during a high-profile military parade in Pyongyang. And Russia warns of a real danger of a World War III as tensions escalate between Moscow and the West over Ukraine. Thanks for joining us. Israeli forces have killed another Palestinian in the occupied West Bank as the regime's atrocities take place on a daily basis. The Palestinian Health Ministry says 20-year-old Ahmed Ibrahim Owaidat succumbed to his injuries after being shot in the head by Israeli troops. The violence happened at a refugee camp near Jericho City early this morning. Since March, Israel has intensified its crackdown across the occupied territories. Palestinians have also been conducting retaliatory attacks against Israelis. Tensions also have been high at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, where Tel Aviv has increased attacks on Palestinian worshippers during the holy month of Ramadan. The daily aggressions have drawn strong condemnations from Muslim countries. Monica Ndil is a correspondent joining us from occupied Ramallah to tell us more. Tell us more about what has happened here and, of course, what we're looking at when it comes to the Al-Aqsa Mosque and what has been developing there.
Well, we have to mention that continued to raid the city's refugees on a basis. This is what happened at dawn. Israeli troops raided the refugee camp of Aqba Jabr, south Jericho, also known as Ariha, and they kidnapped, according to Palestinian Prisoners Affairs Commission, the undercover units kidnapped four Palestinians from the refugee camp of Aqba Jabr, and the clashes took place between Palestinian youths and the Israeli soldiers. Palestinian paramedics later declared that Ahmed Awidat, 20 years old, succumbed to critical injuries he sustained by live bullets at dawn. This 20-year-old Palestinian Palestinians would be taking part in his funeral procession in the afternoon hours. As you have said, the Israeli aggression to Palestinian territories had never stopped. Since the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan, Israeli forces continue, and Israeli police as well, continue to storm the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex almost on a daily basis in order to force Palestinian worshippers out of the Holy Mosque and its complex, as well as to allow Israeli Jewish settlers to raid this Muslim holy site and to tour it freely and desecrate it, of course. These incursions into the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex had caused, of course, clashes as a normal response by the Palestinians, who insisted to face this aggression in order not to allow the Israeli forces or the Jewish settlers to desecrate the Muslim holy site.
I'm looking at a piece of news over here that I'm wondering if you can give us your understanding of it, where the Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid saying that Israel is committed to the status quo at the Al-Aqsa. What does he mean by that? Because everything else is pointing otherwise in terms of the way that they have handled the whole compound there.
Well, we have to that there is some pressure by some European countries as well as the Jordanian king, because since ever it's known that Palestinians have the right to enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque as Muslims and to freely worship inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque and its complex. Preserving, let's say, the status quo, as the Israeli Prime Minister is saying, according to Palestinians, is an attempt to, let's say, deceive the world. Because as a fact on ground, the Israelis are trying, in a way or another, to impose a spacious and partial division of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It's clearly that when they allow the Palestinians only to enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque during the five prayers, then force them to leave the Al-Aqsa Mosque and its complex to allow the Israeli settlers, then this is part of the division in a way or another. When preventing Palestinians from the occupied West Bank and Palestinians from the Gaza Strip to enter Al-Quds in order to reach the Al-Aqsa Mosque, this is kind of a division, Palestinians say. So in a way or another, it's another deceit by the Israeli prime minister to the world in order not to face any kind of pressure anymore.
Indeed. Thank you. Okay. Appreciate that. Mona Kondil, a correspondent there from Occupied Ramallah. Thanks. Moving on, Iran's ambassador to the United Nations says Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories must end in order to make way for the resolution of the conflict in Palestine. Majidat Rahbanchi said full recognition of the inalienable rights of the Palestinian people is also a prerequisite for a resolution of the conflict. Iran's UN ambassador said the regime's atrocities against Palestinians amount to war crimes under international law. He criticized the current stance of the UN Security Council on Israeli aggression, saying that it has only emboldened the regime to perpetuate its occupation and atrocities. Dr. Rahbanchi called on the Security Council to hold Israel accountable for all legal means at its disposal. The Iranian envoy condemned the recent Israeli attacks on Al-Aqsa Mosque, saying any desecration of Muslims' holy sites should not be tolerated. Earlier we talked with journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas. He says that Israel is a remnant of colonialism and an apartheid regime.
Fact of the matter is, and if you have an illegal occupation with a track record of the kind of violence, the kind of brutality, the kind of injustice that the Israeli entity has essentially committed to over the last seven or so decades, then its credibility no longer exists. I mean, there is no way that you can really bring to the table people who are essentially neo-fascists and who've essentially violated the rights, the heritage, the property, and the dignity and honor of an entire people. It's essentially an apartheid, a degenerate effort to colonize a land at a time when we're supposed to have no more colonialism. The fact is that Israel is the last remnant of what we would have known to be colonialism back in the bad old days. What we've got is Anglo-Zionist imperialism using Israel as an entity, as a platform for creating conflict and controlling the region's oil resources, controlling that region's resources in general.
Moving on with the news, Yemenis have held a conference in the capital Sana'a to support the Palestinian cause and to call on the free people of the world to stand by the Palestinian people, especially amid the ongoing Israeli crimes. Abdul Latif al-Washali has more from Sana'a.
Amid the Israeli escalation against Palestinians, Yemenis have held a conference called Palestine, the Central Cause of the Nation, in the Yemeni capital Sana'a. Senior officials have participated in the event to express their support for Palestinians.
The conference was held in Sana'a, the capital, which represents a symbol of a steadfastness and resistance in the face of those who normalize relations with the Israeli enemy. The Yemeni people are a living example of free people, as the central issue for us is Palestine. If Yemen was still ruled by the previous regime, it would have been portrayed as having normalized relations with Israel. But praise be to God, the Yemeni people have been liberated.
Organizers said this conference is a preparation for the celebration of the International Quds Day, as Yemenis will fill the streets of Sana'a to prove their solidarity with the Palestinian cause.
This conference comes as part of preparations for marking Quds Day, which will be unprecedented this year, as the Yemeni people will come out to confirm that Palestine is the central issue of the nation. The message that we are sending through this conference is that the Yemeni people, with all their sects and components, insist that the Palestinian cause is the basis for the solution to all the problems facing the Islamic nation.
During the conference, the president of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat, called for forming official and popular fronts to support the Palestinian people and returning the Palestinian issue to the curricula to emphasize its importance for all generations. Despite everything that is currently happening in the world and the catastrophic situation in the country, people, he say, they will never forget the Palestinian cause. They say it is the time for the free people of the world to prove their support for Palestinians against ongoing Israeli crimes.
North Korea working on plans to boost its nuclear force at a high speed, preparation for future crises. The country's leader, Kim Jong-un, says nuclear weapons are a symbol of national power and should be diversified. According to Kim, North Korea needs to be prepared to deploy its nuclear deterrence anytime, noting that such weapons are primarily aimed at warding off foreign threats. He said that nukes could be deployed in case North Korea's fundamental interests were attacked. Kim made the remarks at a military parade on the occasion of the 90th anniversary of the founding of the Korean People's Revolutionary Army. The parade featured the country's latest intercontinental ballistic missiles. The Russian foreign minister has warned of, quote, a real danger of a World War III as tensions escalate between Moscow and the West over the war in Ukraine. Sergei Lavrov said the danger of a World War III is serious and cannot be underestimated. His remarks came as the U.S. and its European allies are supplying weapons to help Ukraine resist the Russian offensive. Moscow has warned the West of unpredictable consequences if arming Ukraine continues. Lavrov said peace talks with Ukraine will continue, expressing confidence that the conflict will end with the signing of an accord. He criticized Kyiv's approach to the talks, saying goodwill has its limits and will not help negotiations if it is not reciprocal. Lavrov accused Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky of pretending to negotiate. He said that Zelensky is a good actor, but there are, quote, 1,000 contradictions in his remarks. We reached out to writer and political analyst Brian Berletek for comments. He believes that the flow of Western weapons to Ukraine is a major provocation.
It's a major provocation. Essentially, the U.S. and its allies are waging a proxy war against Russia. They're sending these weapons in. They're training Ukrainians how to use them to kill soldiers of the Russian Federation and their allies. And this is on top of an eight-year war the U.S. and its allies were helping Ukraine fight against their own people in eastern Ukraine. So it's a very, very dangerous situation. And we could possibly understand just how dangerous it is if we just reverse the roles and imagine the maybe a nation like Russia or China doing this to the United States, what their feelings and reaction would be to such a situation.
Russia says its missiles have destroyed six railway facilities that were used to deliver foreign weapons to Ukrainian forces in the Donbas region. The Russian Defense Ministry says that its forces also destroyed an arms depot in the Donetsk region, among various other military installations on Monday. According to Ukrainian officials, Russian airstrikes hit railway stations in the country's western and central regions, killing at least five and injuring 18 others. Ukraine's military command says Moscow is trying to bomb railway infrastructures in order to disrupt arms supplies from foreign countries. Meanwhile, Russia says it has pounded 56 Ukrainian military facilities overnight. Moscow also reports that the Ukrainian army has shelled a village in Russia's Belgorod region. Russia warns the U.S. and its allies against supplying more weapons to Ukraine, saying the move is fanning the flames of the war. The Russian ambassador to Washington, Anatoly Antonov, says Moscow sees massive deliveries of arms to Ukraine as an attempt to aggravate the situation and bring about more losses. Antonov says that Russia has sent an official diplomatic note of concern to Washington regarding the issue, but has so far received no reply. His comments come after the U.S. Secretaries of State and Defense said that Washington is prepared to increase its military support for Ukraine.
They need long-range fires. You've heard them express a need for tanks, and we are doing everything that we can to get them the types of support, the types of artillery and munitions that will be effective in this stage of the fight. We're going to push as hard as we can, as quickly as we can, to get them what they need.
What I'm seeing, at least, is that aid is getting here and other distribution points. It's getting out the door incredibly quickly. Again, this place is going to look different 5 or 6 hours from now than it does right now.
Antony Blinken and Lloyd Austin made the comments near the Ukrainian border in Poland. They also visited Kyiv on Sunday night, the highest-level U.S. visit since the start of the Russian war. During a meeting with President Volodymyr Zelensky, the two officials cited U.S. President Joe Biden as saying that American diplomats would return to Ukraine as soon as this week. They also pledged more than $700 million in additional direct and indirect military aid. Meanwhile, Britain says it will send Stormer-armored vehicles carrying anti-air missile launchers to Kyiv. Defense Secretary Ben Wallace says the U.K. will also seek to provide Ukraine with long-range artillery and ammunition, as well as anti-ship missiles. The European Union's Economic Commissioner says the bloc is moving to reduce its reliance on Russian oil and natural gas by two-thirds by the end of the year. Paolo Gentiloni says that is part of a plan to zero the EU's dependence on Russian energy in 5 years. The bloc now imports 40% of its natural gas and 27% of its oil from Russia. This has spelt trouble for the EU amid tensions with Russia over the war in Ukraine. European officials have even warned that nations could face rationing of energy if Russia cuts off its supplies to the bloc. China begins mass testing for the coronavirus in its capital to avoid a lockdown similar to the one that has shut down Shanghai for a month now. Authorities are hoping that their campaign to test 75% of Beijing's 22 million population will root out the spread. In the meantime, residents are stocking up on food and supplies, preparation for possible localized lockdowns. This is fueled by frustration among residents of Shanghai, where 25 million people are confined to their homes. Shanghai authorities waited for about a month and more than 1,000 infections before launching citywide testing. The city now has hundreds of thousands of cases and reported 52 deaths on Tuesday. That does it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, you heard that Imam Khomeini authored the book Kashf al-Asrar in response to the misleading book 1000 Year Secrets, which had been written by Ali Akbar Hakamizade, and erstwhile student of seminary who left for the U.S. while no more wearing the costume of clergymen. It was said that Imam Khomeini's book can be considered as the starting point of his struggles against the Pahlavi regime and his endeavor to establish the Islamic rule. Today, we are going to dwell upon that part of the Imam's struggles which were against the Shah's so-called White Revolution. As usual, the narrator is mainly Imam Khomeini's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi. After the passing away of Grand Ayatollah Hossein Borujerdi in 1961, Iran's Shah, Mohammad Reza, thought that one of the main obstacles against his anti-religious moves and consolidation of his tyrannical rule had gone. Therefore, he started fighting off Islam and ulema very seriously and openly. However, his dream was very soon shattered by Imam Khomeini's uprising, which fell upon him like a nightmare. The Imam raised the banner of a struggle against the regime and its main supporter, the U.S., opening a new chapter in the political and religious atmosphere of the country. Imam Khomeini's wife narrates, "The Imam was a wise, clever, and religious man. After the demise of Ayatollah Borujerdi, he staged uprising against the Shah apparatus, which wanted to set aside religion and march in the path of the West. As he was a very religious and devoted person, whenever the religion and religiosity were mocked at, it was as if his children had been beheaded in front of him. After the late Borujerdi, the Shah intended to set aside clergymen and religion in Iran forever. Of course, he had made the decision at the time of late Borujerdi, but his power wouldn't let the Shah do such a thing. In those days, the man of politics and the field of a struggle against the regime was Ayatollah Kashani, and Mr. Khomeini was acquainted with him, but there was not a political relation in the modern sense, and, as I have said, the Imam's main job was studying and discussion." Imam Khomeini had a positive opinion on the struggles of Ayatollah Kashani, although he had some critical views too. The Imam's wife continues, "My father said that when Mr. Kashani had seen Mr. Ruhullah for the first time, he told my father, 'Where have you found this prodigy? He's a good base for the future.' Mr. Khomeini liked Mr. Kashani's struggles generally and would go to his house too. But it was not that much to say that he had a role in late Kashani's political establishment. After late Borujerdi, the Imam, besides studying and discussion, had become a source of emulation himself and considered himself responsible before events. Thus, he couldn't be silent against deviations and believed that silence against oppression is a bigger oppression. In the winter of 1963, the American President John F. Kennedy advised the Shah to implement the so-called reforms, calling it the White Revolution, or the Revolution of the Shah and the People. This measure comprised issues which were seemingly useful, such as land reforms, granting the right to vote to women, and giving shares of the profits of factories to workers. But the Shah's main aim was to bolster the foundation of his despotic rule and destroying strong social forces such as the clergymen and landowners. Ms. Sarafi says, "In 1963, the government decided to do some reforms. Although it was not that important, it implied issues which would make them important. The Imam believed that the Shah had taken the first step cautiously, but his next steps would be serious danger for Islam and the country's independence. Therefore, he couldn't be silent against the Shah's anti-religious moves." Imam Khomeini's wife, Ms. Sarafi, referring to her protest to the Imam as why he was the only one among the ulema and sources of emulation to oppose the Shah's plan, says, "The Imam felt his duty in this regard and considered himself accountable before God. I told him, why do other ulema and sources of emulation not protest and it is only you who feel their duty? He answered, I don't bother them, lady. By God, I am responsible. If you are ready to see God punishing me on the judgment day, tell me to keep silent. So I was sure that the Imam had a mission which he had to fulfill. Therefore, I always tried to pave the ground for his activity. Imam Khomeini's courageous and explicit opposition to the Shah's so-called referendum infuriated the latter, and there were rumors of arresting the Imam. Yet, Imam Khomeini was so calm and unmoved. Ms. Saghafi narrates as follows. The morning gatherings and narrations of Imam Hussein's tragedy were different from those of the previous years. Little by little, these narrations were finding their true meaning, which was the memory of martyrs and combatants of the path of freedom and religion. They had gradually changed from amusement and stupor to movement and awareness. Preachers had turned the issue from the state of stupor and would prepare the people for resistance against all tortures and torments, preparation for uprising, the uprising like Hussein by his descendant Khomeini. When the rumor prevailed on Imam Khomeini's arrest, one night he told me, if they arrest me, do not be anxious. I told him jokingly, that's good as I will breathe for a while. In the advent of his struggles, the Imam would tell Ahmad, tonight they may arrest me, don't fear. If they come and arrest me, don't do anything. Don't seek help from anyone to relieve me. Even do not accept anyone's money for livelihood.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The French presidential election has drawn to a close. The incumbent Emmanuel Macron was chosen for a second term, but in several cities, including in Paris, his re-election has triggered riots and protests instead of celebrations and joy. Why would there be such a reaction, and why would the elections have one of the lowest turnouts in decades? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how the far right has narrowed the gap with Macron, whether that would pose problems for Macron in the upcoming parliamentary elections, and what Macron means when he says he would change his system of governance.
French President Emmanuel Macron has been re-elected in a comfortable victory, defeating the National Rally's Marine Le Pen, just like in 2017. 6 years after Brexit and the election of Donald Trump, France has still not had a shock victory which opposes right-wing economics and globalization. Macron's victory will be celebrated by high finance in Brussels and by the so-called bourgeois bloc, who are his core supporters. However, the Yellow Vests have said for months that they view a Macron victory as intolerable and as a call to social battle.
Ça veut dire qu'on aura fait trois ans de lutte.
We had 3 years of a struggle but couldn't get Macron out of power. It shows that there is no solution possible by the ballot. Only on the streets, many people will be quite desperate, so things could turn towards extreme social instability and maybe civil war.
Le Pen did see a major rise in support as compared with 2017, but the nationalist bloc still fell short. It seems that many voters simply could not vote in favor of even a rebranded National Front, whose far-right record goes back decades. Abstention hit 28%, the highest since 1969. Blank or purposely spoiled ballots are estimated to be an additional 12%. The populist bloc, who apparently wanted neither candidate, made their presence felt by denying Macron a convincing victory in terms of the overall electorate.
The biggest revolution to come will be philosophical and intellectual. We need a new way of thinking, a new way of being French, and we need a new France. With Le Pen or Macron, we were sure to lose our democratic rights and personal freedoms, and that's unacceptable to many.
Just like in 2017, Macron is likely to face calls that his victory is not a mandate for his proposed policies, such as raising the retirement age this fall. That means the country is likely to experience continued social unrest, which was unprecedented in Macron's first term. France's political future usually first surfaces in their neo-imperial colonies, like with the Yellow Vests. For the first time, the far right won most of France's overseas territories in what could be a preview of 2027. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Well, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Mustapha Traoré joins us. He's an academic and political commentator who joins us from Paris. Also joining us is Ian Williams, international affairs analyst, who joins us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right, welcome to you both. Mustapha Traoré, I'm going to start with you first, since you're in Paris there. We know Macron won, obviously, but it's worth taking a look at the way that these votes came in and the significance. Looking at, for example, some of the stats on this, this abstention rate was recorded to be the highest since the year 1969, which is what I'd like to ask you as to why you think that is. And you also have a sizable number of the voters who refused to vote for either of the two leading contenders. Again, your answer on that.
Yes, of course. Yes, so the third thing is that we had the same elections that we had 5 years ago. People are a bit disappointed. They've got the feeling that they were stolen their right to express their voice. Okay, and so that was the case 5 years ago. There's a repetition this year. So I think this is one of the main reasons for the higher rate of people who decided to not to vote for these elections. And so Macron, we know what he's going to do. And those who voted for Macron, if you analyze it, if you ask, if you try to investigate on the people who voted for him, we'll find that lots of people voted for him because they did not want Marine Le Pen to become the president of the country. So it was more a vote against Marine than a vote for Macron. And if we analyze it, the situation, I think, is that Macron is going just to carry on the same policies he he was doing, he's been doing for since he was elected. There's he's got no reason to change anything because it works for him. And according to the French law, a candidate or a president can be elected just twice. So you have the right of, you have two mandates. There is no reason for him to change. This is going to be his last mandate.
Yeah, we're going
to... he's got a wild card. Okay, wild card to put into place all kind of policies.
Sure, we're going to challenge you on that, hopefully, and see where we can go with that. Ian Williams, again, we're breaking down the way that these votes came in and its significance. And one of the things that our guests there talked about is how people came out to vote for Macron as to not have Le Pen win. At the same time, and I'm merging these two questions, you have the gap between the two rivals to have halved since 2017. And at the same time, you're having many to move to the far right. So we don't go through each specific result here. What do these mean in terms of the way that it would affect France, in terms of the electorate, in terms of the French? Ian Williams.
Well, I'm increasingly wondering just how relevant the definitions of left and right are across the Western world, because they seem to be detached from economics. Here we have a right-wing candidate in France, and you could say to some extent Farage and Trump are capitalizing on the discontents of the dispossessed, the unemployed, the people in the Rust Belt, the people in the countryside. They're appealing to them. This is the traditional territory of the left. It's interesting, there's an inversion, and the right has often successfully managed to make cultural issues. So the big issue in France is partly the fact that pensions are being taken off people and they're losing work, but also they've managed to divert the whole issue to whether Muslim women wear hijabs in public or not. It's a bit like in the US, where the whole issue of gay and transphobic elements, it takes a wholly disproportionate role. Which bathroom do you use? So it doesn't matter if you're starving. It doesn't matter if you don't have a job. It doesn't matter if you're dying because you don't get health service. But it's very important that that people use the right bathrooms. And it's similar in France. The cultural issues, the signifying, are filled the gap left by the traditional economics, because the traditional left has walked away. There are no, there's no vision. Without vision, the people will perish. And they have consciously felt, a lot of working people are desperately and genuinely feeling neglected because the government doesn't listen to them. They say that they don't want pensions reduced to 62 if you spent a life working in the coal mines or on ships on the railways. The government doesn't care because the government has accountants. It has calculators that tell them that this is what they have to do to balance the books. But somehow the balance in the books never includes a wealth tax. It never includes hitting the real rich. I don't believe Le Pen is going to do any of those things. But all she has to do is to talk about it to get elected. It's just like Trump. Trump did every one of his policies has favored the plutocrats in America. Yeah, he hasn't in any way implemented them, but he gets their votes because he says he's going to. The left doesn't even say that anymore. Joe Biden is, was a creature of the insurance companies of Delaware.
Okay.
And he's a very uninspiring character as well. But, it's the same here with Macron. He is not somebody who you go to the barricades for.
Sure.
You might go to the barricades against, as we're now seeing.
Well, many are saying there's not even a middle anymore. And the ones who were there are moved either to the left or the right. So then it becomes the confusion. But, we need to talk about this, Mostafa Chaouri, in France. As you can tell us more than anybody else probably, people matter because French love to protest. They go out to the streets and they want to earn the rights that were given to them. Macron has gone against that. We have seen that throughout the 5 years. More importantly, when you take a look at the stat where it says, for example, not only had 80% of the participants lost trust in all the political parties, 40% no longer felt attached to any movement. How would this be important? Why would this be important for France and for Macron vis-a-vis the variety of things that he wants to enact because he says, I'm going to have a new kind of governance.
Yes, so I think you're right when you said that protesting is part of the French DNA. But the thing is that this is not the only thing that is part of the French DNA. Racism as well. So in fact, this is why I think what is happening to France, the only responsible is the French population, the voters, because they are those who are buying all these commands, all these stories about hijab, about the veil, and they are buying it, they are watching, they are interested in it. And we must not forget that the score of Marine Le Pen is very high. 41% of the population voted for her. So even if in these 41%, you have people who just wanted the system to collapse, but they still voted for her. So I think that in France, France is a country of revolution. You have lots of revolutionaries. It's a country where people protest, but at the same time, it is a country with a form of racism that is part of the French mindset. And this is one fact. Macron is very clever. He's playing with it. So they play with it, which means that they boost racist ideologies so that people focus on this one. And then at the end, we have just two candidates. We have Marine Le Pen and Macron. Okay. And they could have voted for Mélenchon. Mélenchon is the only one who represents the left today in France. But the thing is that people are not interested. Lots of people prefer, if you look at the Socialist Party, I think the number of votes they got is a shame. That's a shame for a party that used to be one of the main political parties of the country.
Sure.
But how come you have Mélenchon? They could have just joined Mélenchon. Why is it that they're all split like this?
Well, we'll see where the support is going to end up. Let's take a look at some of the economic aspects behind Macron. And one of the things that's truly amazing that Ian Williams, correct me if I'm wrong, many are not grasping what it meant, is the fact that it was advertised that Macron is riding high on an economic GDP growth of 7%. Now, what's not being highlighted is the fact that it dipped negative 7% during the COVID-19 pandemic. And it's a natural increase, which is called a COVID bounce back for countries when they come out of the COVID pandemic, two-year, rest or whatever you want to call it, that's just natural for there to be a large GDP increase. Because if we look at the projections, they go back down to 1.2%, maybe 2%, and it tapers off in those areas for the following years. How is Macron going to deal with the French economy with inflation staring him right in the face?
I'm not sure about inflation, but statistics often lie. And in this case, I think people are voting based on their pockets. If they go into the baker's and they can't afford the bread, it's, bread, peace and land. It's an old harbinger of resolution. And they can't all eat cake. Especially they can't get the credit cards to buy the cake. And I think it was interesting because none of the usual paradigms actually hold on a one-to-one basis. It's a very complex equation here. The overseas departments, overwhelmingly black and immigrant, voted overwhelmingly for Le Pen. So Guadeloupe, Martinique and the others. And I saw a quote from a trade unionist I think it was Guadeloupe, who said the protests expressed the depth of suffering, inequality, poverty and exclusion felt by the people. So they feel this, and they're going to hit at whoever's in authority is responsible for this. And none of the people, none of the contenders actually came up with any coherent vision even. I'm not even talking about a plan. There's no idea we are all in this together. We want to look after our own people. We want to build a health service. We want to build education. We had none of this inspiration, not even the usual fraternity, equality, etc. That it's been argued on statistics and particularly these wedge issues, I call them. Mm-hmm. The wedge issues that people come in, it's the hijab or the gay rights or Europe. You notice Le Pen actually dropped the proposal to move out of the Eurozone, not because it wasn't particularly popular with people, but because the people who are going to pay for her election didn't want it, the business people.
Sure.
So, you know, we have all of these factors playing in, and we've somehow got to avoid the old reductionism of left thing that neoliberals did over the years was to destroy the structures of society. They destroyed the unions, they destroyed the societies, they destroyed the communities and rendered them, you know, useless and voiceless. And that's what we're left with now. And,
okay.
You know, they're scratching their head thinking, oh, look at this, we've smashed the house down and it won't build itself. But that's what they've done. They smashed the society down. They smashed those structures. They smashed the solidarity, the collectivist solidarity structures that France was actually very good at.
Okay.
They took the largest communist party in Western Europe and trashed it. The communist party did a lot of that for themselves. But then they did the same for the socialists. But the socialists self-destructed because they adopted chameleon-like. They became conservatives somehow.
Right.
Mélenchon is different. And, you know, under the circumstances, okay. He didn't do so badly, but I hope he does better in the future.
Sifting through what I wanted to present to you here, Mostafa Traoré, for a question I think is best described by this statement by Macron, which shows the depth of the problem that the French are experiencing, unlike how he has been touted for his economic advancements. This is what he has said himself. Quote, our project for 2022, it's solidarity and social progress. French people who work should not have to spend their whole salary filling up their petrol tanks and shopping. That's unfair. So there you have it. He's saying that. Is that how bad it is? Is that what the French are experiencing right now?
Yes, it is. And the predictions for the future are not nice either. The reason why, because we've got the crisis going on in Ukraine, Russia, and also there are lots of crises, small crises, happening in the African continent. And we know that France, the French economy, relies more on the resources they can get from the African continent. Without Africa, France is nothing. It's not just me saying it. It's former President Jacques Chirac who used to say it. Without the former colonies, France is nothing. Okay, France is just exploiting through the African currency, francs CFA, through the gas they have in northern Mali they get for free. The uranium they got from Niger. Niger is one of the poorest countries in the world. But if you look at all the uranium that we use in France, it comes from Niger. So this is, look at all these islands, Guadeloupe, Martinique, all the resources we get from free. And when I say we get from free, because I live in France, so I benefit from it as well.
Okay. Uh-huh.
So if now what is happening in African continent, you have people getting aware of what is going on, protesting, and trying to get their total independence.
Sure.
So which means that if they stop their what we call La France-Afrique, this relationship in which they are exploited by France, if they stop, if they put it to an end, France is going to suffer. And for sure, the price of oil, the price of goods, and so on, and our purchasing power in France is going to be affected.
Sure. Well, he's got to do something rather quickly. I'm not going to ask any more economic related questions here, Ian Williams, because we're running out of time. We're looking at Jean-Luc Mélenchon's voters, and maybe this is coming from a source that is anti-Macron or is a sore loser, maybe. But it's saying that these voters are now going to want to take revenge on Macron, and they're going to show that soon in the parliamentary elections that are coming up. Do you think, given the demographics of the voters, that perhaps Macron is going to have a hard time to hold a majority there in parliament and therefore, consequentially, not be able to enact any reforms? We know he's got this 30 billion euro plan that involves a whole lot of things, but of course that's in the works. Who knows if it's going to really be executed?
I think he's going to have a great deal of problems maintaining a parliamentary majority, because it's a much closer reflection of what's happening in society. Mélenchon might well come into his own there, as opposed to the weird presidential system imposed by Charles de Gaulle on this republic. Quite who's controlling what is always a big problem. But he's going to have problems controlling the parliament, and the parliament is Mélenchon, the socialists, and the other dissidents will be there. And who knows? You might even get the socialists and the National Front united as one against reducing the pension age, because they're both appealing to the same constituency. Yeah. He might have a great deal of difficulty getting it through. But, as we saw with the strikes the other year over the railways, when he tried this, when he tried to get this neoliberal project through, it got a lot of support from general public who, there is a collectivist and dirigist element in France. And Macron is basically saying that the government should butt out, leave people to sink or swim on their own, and let the free market look after it, which is the same message coming from Keir Starmer and Boris Johnson and most of the politicians in America. And it's a message that is not palatable in the end. And they're going to suffer for it electorally. And unfortunately, the people in those suburbs, in the Corn Belt and the Rust Belt, they're going to suffer for it as well.
Well, final question to you, Mustafa Traoré. Macron, he has said he is going to be the president of all the French in the next 5 years. What do you see that will lead him down that road in its success, in terms of the success rate here or its failure? How would you rank that?
I think that we all know Macron. He never sticks to his words. So, of course, he's going to be the president of all French citizens. This is officially, this is his position now. But the thing is that is he going to work for the interests of all French citizens? This is another question.
Very well, we'll end it there. Thank you very much for that. Mustafa Traoré, academic and political commentator from Paris. Ian Williams, a pleasure. International affairs analyst from New York. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mika Vitale and the team, it's goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadali, and you are now listening to the program, Islamic Upbringing. In this program, you will discuss issues, relevant questions, and other fields regarding the Islamic upbringing of children. And we would like to stress that the answers that we provide in this program are all based upon the narrations of the household of the Prophet, and of course of the Prophet himself, and upon the Holy Quran, supplemented with scientific research. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend, Sheikh Ali Himani, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for joining us.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. It's my pleasure to be here in your studio.
Sheikh, today I would like to talk about a very weird phenomena, something that happens to teenagers when they hit this teenage phase of their lives, and that is like a switch is flipped. They suddenly start to behave aggressively, violently, very confrontational, very provocative in schools, with their friends, or with any authority figure, for that matter, to be honest, in their families. And so I guess what I want to know, and many parents want to know, why and how can we manage this?
Correct. This is a very common scenario. You will find this in the boys and in the girls.
Right, yeah.
And this, a lot of people associate this with the hormonal changes, right? But I would associate this with the personality and identity. Because this person is trying to establish his identity. This person is trying to establish who he is, what kind of a person he is, what kind of a role he's going to play